session number 27083, reel 32.
So, Sir Henry, you met this imposing figure at the top of the stairs.
And this indeed was Colonel Thorne, so we had this this curious meeting. He couldn't have been a nicer man, and he was betting me. I don't think he was probably saying that I couldn't have been a nicer man either, but I passed muster, and that was the main thing. And, of course, there was lots of telephoning round home and to my outlaws, in-laws-to-be, and so on. And the long and the short of it was that we were married in Holy Trinity, Brompton, on the 15th of February the following year, 1958. And I had a very difficult conversation. First time I took Mary home to my mother, and I was devoted to my mother, though she could be difficult at times, and she was on this occasion. I think, dare I say, she didn't want to let me go, so to speak, and that's a perfectly natural inclination. But she took to Mary at once and realized what a nice girl she was. And I remember we were out in the garden. This was at our other home down in Devon, a farm, really. And Mary had been sent off into the house to put the spuds on for lunch or some such. And my mother rounded on me and said, I hope you're going to have a proper engagement. And I knew exactly what was coming, because she was engaged for Lord knows how long. And I said, yes, yes, of course. What do you mean by that? And I said, well, proper engagement? Proper engagement. When? And I said, well, we thought of getting married about the middle of February. Middle of February, she said. That's barely 2 months away. I was engaged for 14 months. And I said, I couldn't stand it. And I think I won that round. Anyway, I was quite determined. And at about that time, no, I think it was actually before I had become engaged, I was rung up one morning by Peter Mitchell, who'd been the navigating officer of Newcastle, and we'd been great chums, and you know, we usually went ashore together and all that sort of thing, and I had just seen his engagement in the paper, and he rang up to ask if I would be his best man. And I remember having to reply that could he indicate when he had in mind to get married, because I was actually pretty broody myself, but I hadn't popped the question yet. And he told me the date. And in the event, I was his best man up in Essex or Suffolk or wherever it was, precisely 1 week to the day before our own wedding. So that was a good dress rehearsal. And we've kept in very close touch ever since, but sadly he died about a year ago. Well then, the next assignment was Mary became pregnant, and I used to go very much by the motto of Benson and Hedges cigarettes, only the best will do. I smoked at the time. I rather overcorrected on cigarettes, as a matter of fact, because I used to smoke Benson and Hedges. And now, because I was engaged, I thought, you know, you've got to watch it, think of the budget and all that sort of thing. And I overcorrected. And came right down to Woodbines, and they were foul. So there it was, but I'll follow that up a little later. And the Mary's gyno was the famous John Peel, who was the Queen's gyno. And we had it all lined up. We had a local car. We'd moved into a flat in Pont Street. It was the upper story of one of those old Pont Street houses, which the landlord, the landlord lived in the basement, and he let out either floors or rooms or pairs of rooms or whatever, and so forth. And it was all very tricky because he was pulling a racket somehow, and he didn't have the normal entry phone or anything like that. He gave you a coded number for the number of rings on the only bell, and so forth. And we were right at the top. And our sitting room was, I suppose, the communal bedroom for the underhousemaid, the kitchen maid, and the scullery maid in those days. And the bathroom was probably the butler's room, and so on. But it was 84 stairs up, and there was no lift. There was a food lift, but it wouldn't take a human being. And if one asked anybody for a drink, and particularly if it was more than one person, you heard the bell go 5 times was our thing, and down the stairs you went and opened the front door, and you got about halfway back up again when you heard the bell ring 5 times again, and so on. And so we got round this by taking a salmon rod up, and we would warn our visitors, once they had pressed the bell 5 times, to stand back on the pavement, and we would lure the key to the door on the end of a line at the end of a salmon rod out of the window. And in the summer months, when it was broad daylight, of course, the locals thought this, or anybody passing by on the pavement, thought this was absolutely riveting. And why nobody got knocked down, I can't imagine. And in the winter, we put a little, a tiny torch on the end, and so on. So that worked very well. Well, we lined up a car from the local garage to be at a short stay for Mary to go off into hospital. And that was all booked, and so on. And the day came, and it came at about 6 o'clock in the morning, where she realized that things were imminent. And so I ordered the car, and I accompanied her to King's College Hospital, and that was fine. And needless to say, I was faced with a busy day. And the first thing I had to do that morning was to accompany the Second Sea Lord, which was Pinky Holland Martin, and one of his other directors, down to Greenwich, where he was lecturing on the officer structure and that sort of thing. And I was to go as the professional standby who supposedly knew the answers. And I revealed this to Derek Hetherington was the captain, nice man, who curiously, the only naval officer I ever knew do it, was adept at knitting, and he used to knit all sorts of funny little woolly garments when he was alone driving his ship and that sort of thing. And he had a grown-up family, I think, by then. He was quite a bit older than I was. And he told me that yes, he understood all about this, and no, it wasn't a thing you ever got over, and so on and so forth. And we went to Greenwich, and that went all right. And I got back, and I was picking up the bits over a sandwich at my desk when I suddenly thought, my God. I never asked John Peel what his religion was, and I was sort of vaguely aware that if you are a Roman Catholic, I think I've got this right, and it comes to a crisis as to whether you say the life of the mother or the life of the child, their quite strong faith is that you say the life of the child. And I wasn't going to have any of this. And so I immediately rang through to the hospital, only to find that John Peel was scrubbed and in theatre. He was going to have a guy now.
Caesar,
yes. And they said, well, he's in theatre. I said, well, get him out of the theatre. And they didn't like it, but they got him out. And he didn't like it one little bit, and he was quite a brusque man. And I had to say, which didn't endear me any more to him, what is your religion? And I said, if there's any question of, I want my wife saved and not the infant. And that was that one, one of my nastier moments. And that really brings me pretty well to the end of that period of my time in London. I was then appointed. I was first appointed as second in command of a cruiser, and then that was changed, and I was appointed to command a battle class destroyer, which was much more to the point. And that comes in our next round.
So Henry, we've had a short break, and now just before we discuss your command of a battle-class destroyer, can I just ask you this question? You've just been dealing with a period of restructuring of the Navy where a significant number of officers were axed, and where the Navy was slimmed down probably quite a bit in size. You faced a similar problem to this towards the end of your career when you were First Sea Lord and the battles with the Conservative government of the day, which we'll come on to in due course. But can you give me any idea, any indication of the effect on morale that Duncan Sands' his cuts had when he was putting them through in the late 50s?
I'll do my best. I think that it came as something as a shock to the Navy. I think that it was regarded as somewhat excessive in terms of ships and equipment and in terms of people. In terms of people, I think like any organization, after a period of time, probably quite a long period, but it depends, you start to grow an element of fat. And there comes a time when the fat needs to be pared away and you'll get back to a lean and hence more efficient operating body. I think that a certain amount of fat had accumulated and that in terms of people it was right. And whilst one can argue that the cuts in people were made necessary by the cuts in ships and establishments and so forth, I don't think that the two were entirely in balance. And I think that as regards people, Duncan Sands wasn't far off the ball. In terms of ships and equipment and so on, I think he was somewhat excessive. But there again, you had to balance it between the old dichotomy, quality and quantity. And I think on the whole, although it seemed, it made one feel somewhat better at the time, but on the whole, I think it was judged that something along those lines had probably become necessary. And in a way, I was not I was not old enough, I was not sufficiently responsible to be devastated by what in fact he had in mind. Now that sounds a rather facile thing to say, but it's the truth. And as far as I was concerned, I wasn't going to be axed. I knew a number of people that were. Some of them I regretted because they were good. Quite a number I didn't regret at all because they weren't all that good, and so on. But I regretted the ships and equipment.
So ships and equipment went as well as men?
Oh, yes. Very much so.
And this was seen as being a slimming down of the Navy post-Korean War, which had been over 3 or 4 years, and presumably just a reduction in our international commitments? Or?
Yes. It was a reduction in the overall strength of the Navy.
Because the government perceived that the commitments it would ask from it or impose on it would be lesser than they otherwise had been before.
No, because the government wanted the money.
So it's the old story even then of giving you less but wanting the same.
Yes, exactly that. But it is the government of the day that runs the country, and therefore you have to fall in and obey the last order, distasteful though it may be. And it was very distasteful cutting your friends. So there it was. And we came down to, I can't remember, I think I mentioned this before, I can't remember the precise figure we came from, but I think it was 120,000, 130,000. We certainly came down to 90,000, and that was the plan, which was quite a jump.
Quite a substantial.
But it wasn't done, although I talked earlier about the Admiralty Fleet Order coming out in November, so that everybody would know how they stood by Christmas when they went on leave. They didn't all go, even by January or anything like that. They went over a phase period which lasted, as I recall, up to 2 years or more even, and it was very carefully worked out to, on the one hand, maintain continuity, and on the other hand, to do as decent a thing as in the Cirques was possible by the individual. And of course, there were a lot of sailors involved too.
And was there a program of rehabilitation is the wrong word, reintegration or integration into civilian life? Was there a program of training, if you like, or preparation for that, or did people just come to the end of their service? Admittedly, with a long period of notice they were going to do so, but just come to the end of their service and then have to make their own way in civilian life?
As far as I can recall, and certainly none of that came my way, it was the latter. I don't think there was any deliberate or increased rehabilitation. But I may be wrong in saying that.
Right. Thank you.
Shall we go on?
Yes, I'm sorry to have
not a bit.
Course of digression there. You're going to take command.
Well, as I say, I was finally appointed to take command of a battle class destroyer, in fact, the Dunkirk, about which more in a moment. I was still just in London, and I was about to go off at the end of my job in the Admiralty and get some leave before joining my ship and taking over. And I'd been out with my wife, and we'd been married then, I suppose, just about a year. And we'd been out having dinner with, you may recall the name, Ivan Sarrell, who was the chief staff officer to the Admiral commanding the Coronation Naval Brigade. And we had a perfectly ordinary, quiet dinner with him in his flat, and he was a very good cook. And I'd returned my wife to our little flat in Pont Street, and I was taking the babysitter home. And in the vicinity of, it was down in Battersea at a roundabout there, and I was driving our for the first time ever, new little Austin, whatever it was called in those days, when we got clobbered by a Tate and Lau long-distance tanker towing a trailer, pushed off the road, and as I subsequently discovered, through a plate glass window and ended up inside a shoe shop. But the first thing I knew about it was on a rather hard trolley in the casualty department of St. Thomas's Hospital. And bits of me were being stitched up and so forth. And I had, whatever it was, three cracked ribs, a broken collarbone, and a hell of a welt over my right eye. And it was all very sore and uncomfortable, and so on. But they only kept me in hospital for 24 hours, if that. I think it was probably out next day. And I went back, bandaged up and so forth. And I remember Michael Pollock, who I mentioned previously, he was coming to a drink party together with various others, because this was really our farewell before we moved out into the country. We didn't have a house of our own then, for my relatively short leave before going and joining my ship. And I went daily into St. Thomas's, and the thing that really perturbed me more than anything else was the blow to the head, because the effect was to cause me to see double. It particularly caused me to see double if I was looking down, and as I subsequently discovered, if I had almost anything to drink, but certainly if I had one too many, or if I got a bit tired, I immediately started to see double. And the very nice ophthalmologist there told me that, and I think he knew what he was talking about, he said, I'm very confident that you will be all right, but it'll take time. And for the next 2 months, you must not drink any alcohol, you must never get tired, and you will find that it will gradually come back, but it will take time. And faced with the prospect of taking over command, my first command, and then sailing something like 3 days later for that very intensive 8 weeks workup at Portland, the business of alcohol was easy. That was just a matter of self-control. The business of not getting tired was frankly a joke, because you would be very tired the whole time, and so on. And the physio that saw me said, "Now, if you don't mind a bit of discomfort," was how she put it, "and you don't mind a bit of a lump afterwards, I can hasten the resetting of your collarbone," which he proceeded to do very uncomfortably. And I still got a great ridge, I've forgotten which side it is, this side, I think. But I was lucky to get away with it as lightly as I did, because the babysitter who was with me fractured her thigh and was really quite ill for some time. So that was the end of my time in the Admiralty on that occasion, and I went off on leave. And I remember, can't remember which day of the week it was, and it doesn't really matter, but we managed to get digs at Ivy Bridge, just outside Plymouth, because Dunkirk was recommissioning in Devonport. And my wife drove me down, and because I couldn't drive, and we got to the digs and so forth, and the next day she drove me down to the ship. And I met my predecessor, a nice man, and I walked once around the upper deck with him, and then sank exhausted into an armchair in his cabin. And he left. And after lunch, my wife left, and she picked me up later that evening. In the afternoon, I had to make the usual sort of calls and things, including on the commander-in-chief, whose name escapes me for the moment, but it'll come back. Marvelous man. Very good, very fine officer indeed. And I came absolutely clean to him and said, sir, this is a problem. It was quite clear to me that I, in my state then, I was not fit to drive. I was also quite clear that the straw commands didn't grow on the branch of every tree. And it was an awful dilemma, solved over that weekend by, curiously, the fleet engineer officer. And we had been due to sail on, I think we were commissioning on the Friday or the Saturday, and sailing the following Monday or Tuesday to Portland to work up. Hard grind, and necessarily so. And the fleet engineer officer said that the state of material in all the ships of this squadron was so bad through lack of maintenance that it would be a complete waste of everyone's time to go to Portland because we'd merely break down. That wasn't very encouraging news. But his recommendation was that we should remain in harbour for 3 weeks to get things put right. Not just us, the whole squadron. And that was done. And that saved my bacon, because otherwise I don't know what would have happened. And I had sworn to CNC that 48 hours before we finally sailed, I would let him know whether or not I was fit to drive. And this was quite a thing hanging over my head.
A judgment you had to make, not, for example, a medical officer. So he would take your judgment.
I said that I would make it. Not sure that the medical officer could really do it, because it was a problem of seeing double. However, there it was. And I commissioned the ship with a patch over my bad eye until I learned from the medics that that was a bad thing to have because it would weaken the other eye or do something funny. So I had to take that off. And with my new ship's company, I to them was their new and unknown captain, it must have been a hoot, because as I mentioned, particularly looking down, when you came to a hatchway, there were two hatchways, and one was real and one was phantom. And if you made to go down the phantom one, it was a point of doubtfulness to any onlooker, to say the least. And it was also, you got tired very quickly. But every other night or so, when it got dark, as it did, because it was in November, I think, I would go up to my open bridge with a pair of binoculars and look along the line of the jetty and imagine whether I could bring the ship alongside with my double vision. And wherever I looked, there were rows of lights along the jetty, but for every real light, there was a phantom light, and so on. And then I had to disconsolately clamber down the quite steep ladder, the real one, not the phantom one, back to my cabin, wondering how this was going to clear up and when. And so it went on, and it was a very trying time, to say the least. Well, I mean, for example, on the morning that I put on uniform for the first time since the accident, so that my wife could drive me down to take over the ship, it took me an hour and a quarter to dress. And I could only get my arms through my shirt and into my monkey jacket and that sort of thing by putting one at a time on top of the chest of drawers and somehow wriggling through. That was the sort of state I was in. Well, the days passed, and I had a look around the ship, and I didn't much like what I saw. She was slovenly, she was dirty, she was unkempt. Nothing to do with the ship's company, which was a new ship's company. And so early on in the following week after commissioning, I fell all the boys in and told them what I thought of the ship, and said, this is to be your home for the next 18 months, 2 years, as well as mine, and you won't like any more than I do living in a dirty ship. So now we will work until she's clean. And bless them, they did. And they were put hard to it. And this got to the notice of the Admiral Superintendent in the dockyard. I don't know how, but it did. Who was very chuffed that I'd taken that line, because it was needed, frankly. Well, I'll skip the rest. We gradually got the ship a bit more together. She wasn't smart, but she was passable, put it that way. And I got to know a lot of the ship's company. I had in the wardroom,